Morning, church.
Morning.
Tell you what. Okay, I'm on. If you ever want to clear a room,
you can just cough a little bit and you can clear a room, is what I have learned. I was driving the bus earlier this week and had some kids who have, you know, lingering colds or allergies or all sorts of things, and every time a kid would cough, all the heads would turn. Like, what are you exposing us to? What are you doing to us? It is definitely an unsettling time in our society. And this morning I had planned on continuing the series that we've been going through. It's called Where We Live, and we were going to talk about resolving conflict in our families. But given the events of this week, I thought it might be more prudent to address the elephant in the room, and then after you've been at home with your family for a week, then we'll talk about resolving conflict in the family. So the events surrounding the emergence of coronavirus and the disease that it causes, COVID-19, has shaken not just our community, but our state, our nation, and indeed the entire world. Collegiate and professional sports have either canceled or suspended their seasons. Concerts and conferences have virtually vanished. There have been closings of colleges and school systems. Some have extended their breaks. Some have gone to online classes. Some have shut down altogether. Some churches have eliminated classes like we're going to be doing in the coming weeks. Some have altered their service times and gone to a single service. Some have canceled services altogether and just opted to teach there online. And I know churches, even in our area, who are doing all three of those options. Some are doing nothing. But indeed, we can look around this morning. We just look at our midst and we can see that there are a lot of people who are normally with us who aren't with us this morning, all because of the highly infectious nature of this one microscopically tiny virus, right? So rather than pretending it's business as usual and continuing on, we're going to do something this morning that's a little bit different. It's going to be kind of like a family meeting where we kind of think about and look at this one driving question. What should we do? What should we do? As individuals, as a congregation, as a community, what should we do? And sort of define, we need to find some moral resources, and to find these moral resources needed to tackle COVID-19, both the physical effects and the psychological fears that accompany it, we need to look at the resources that are built into the past. For us as Christians, this means we examine how our brothers and sisters who have gone before us, how they have dealt with these times of crisis, whether it's famines or droughts or plagues. What have they done? How have they gotten through this? So the Christian response to plagues begins with some of Jesus' most well-known teachings. These were the teachings Christians cited when they were trying to figure out what should we do at this time. And so you have very familiar teachings of Jesus, well-known teachings of Jesus, teachings like do unto others as you would have them do unto you, right? You know that. Or Jesus saying, love your neighbor as yourself. Or greater love has no man than this, that he should lay down his life for his friends. That's what Jesus taught. And so you have these kind of general moral statements. And now it's up to the church to interpret those in their specific circumstances. And so we have the account given to us by the Apostle Paul about how this played out in early Gentile churches when the Christians in Jerusalem were facing persecution and famine. And indeed, the famine was widespread. Many of the churches Paul was going to were experiencing drought and famine as well. And this is what we read from 2 Corinthians 8, verses 1 through 4. The Apostle Paul says, and now, brothers and sisters, we want you to know about the grace that God has given to the Macedonian churches. In the midst of a severe trial, very severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. For I testify that they gave as much as they were able, even beyond their ability, entirely on their own. They urgently pleaded with us for the privilege of sharing in this service of the Lord's people. They were struggling. And in the midst of their struggles, they begged to help others who were struggling. So as crazy and as brash as it may seem, the Christian ethic in a time of famine or plague or crisis, it considers that our own lives should always be regarded as less important than those of our neighbor. That, at least, was how this earliest church interpreted this, what they believed. It's what they taught. It's what they lived. So what does this look like in later practice as it comes down through the centuries? How was this interpreted? And so we've got several examples that we're going to go through this morning. During the plague periods of the Roman Empire, Christians really made a name for themselves. Historians suggest that during the terrible Antonin Plague of the second century, which killed off, by the way, about a quarter of the entire Roman Empire, 25% of the entire Roman Empire, this led to the spread of Christianity because Christians were actively caring for the sick. They were the ones who were looking after those who were dying. Not only that, but their worldview was way better for dealing with this than the pagan worldview. Because in the pagan worldview, what you have is plagues and famine and drought and all this stuff. That's the work of angry and unpredictable, capricious gods. And Christians said, no, this is not because the gods are angry with us. This is because this is the product of a broken creation in revolt against a loving God. And that's a lot easier for people to understand and grasp. It gives them hope. The more famous epidemic, even more famous than this one, was what's called the Plague of Cyprian. It was made famous, it was named after a bishop who gave a really full account of this disease, what it did and what it looked like in their communities and how they responded. It was probably a disease, we think, based on the descriptions, probably related to what we think of as modern-day Ebola, right? And the Plague of Cyprian was reportedly killing 5,000 Roman citizens, like citizens of the city of Rome. 5,000 citizens per day. 5,000 citizens per day dropping dead in the city. And it triggered this explosive growth of Christianity. And in his sermon, Cyprian told Christians not to grieve for the plague victims because they're in heaven now. But he says, redouble your efforts in caring for the living. And he had a fellow bishop in Alexandria, down in Alexandria, Egypt, which was another epicenter of the church. And by the way, Alexandria was particularly hard hit by this plague as well. And the bishop there, his name was Dionysius, he described how Christians, this is what he just said in his sermon, he says, heedless of danger, they took charge of the sick, attending to their every need. This made such a big impact that when a century later, there was another disease that cropped up. You have the emperor of the Roman Empire, his name was Emperor Julian, and he was a terrible guy. I mean, he was actively pagan, but we mean that not just that he worshipped other gods, but he was just a terrible human being. And he complained bitterly about the behavior of the Christians. He called them the Galileans because this religion sprang out of Galilee. But he complained bitterly about the behavior of these Christians versus the behavior of his own pagan brothers and sisters, right? So he blamed the growth of Christianity on, and I quote, their benevolence to strangers, their care for the graves of the dead, and their pretended holiness of their lives. That was what really upset him. And elsewhere he wrote, for it is a disgrace that the impious, ungodly, right, because they don't worship any of the gods that are around, the impious Galileans, Christians, support not only their poor, but ours as well. In 1527, another plague comes along. It's the bubonic plague. You might have heard of it. It hit Wittenberg, Germany, which you probably don't know, but it is the most famously known for being where Martin Luther was ministering. And a lot of people were, especially the wealthy, were fleeing the city. And Martin Luther refused to flee the city to protect himself. Rather, he stayed and insisted that he care for the sick. And his refusal, by the way, wasn't at no cost. It cost him the life of his daughter, Elizabeth. But it started, he wrote in the midst of this, he wrote a tract called Whether Christians Should Flee the Plague. And he provides a clear articulation of what he believed was a Christian's epidemic response. This is what he said. He said, "We die at our posts. Christian doctors cannot abandon their hospitals. Christian governors cannot flee their districts. Christian pastors cannot abandon their congregations. This plague does not dissolve our duties. It turns them into crosses on which we must be prepared to die." In 1873, the population of Nashville was a booming 25,800 souls. Hard to believe, isn't it? But a cholera epidemic first appeared on the scene in the city on May 6th, 1873. It appears on May 6th between June 7th and July 1st. Nashville records about 1,000 deaths. So something like 1/25 of the population dies. And at that time, wealthier people were fleeing the city. They were going on holiday. Just go to the cabin, go fishing, go do something, get out of the way, right? And so David Lipscomb, you may have heard of him. He has a famous school named after him, right? David Lipscomb lived 10 miles out of the city. He did not live in the city of Nashville, but he remained in Nashville to assist the sick, and including African Americans, which was a big taboo at this particular time. He used his cart and buggy to haul around the nuns, the Catholic Sisters of Mercy, and the Franciscan nuns. He hauled them around because they knew how to care for sick, and he was went with them, right? And even as these Christian affluent families fled the city, Lipscomb wrote in the July issue of the Gospel Advocate, and this is what Lipscomb said. He said, "Christian men and women should be prudent and cautious in such surroundings. It is proper, we think, to send women and children who are incapable of service to the sick and are liable to the disease, send them beyond the reach when possible. But for able-bodied Christian men and women to be flying from the city when their brethren and neighbors and fellow creatures are suffering and dying for lack of attention and help is such a contradiction in ideas, we know of no means of reconciling them." 1918. There was an influenza epidemic, we also call it the Spanish flu, that was so widespread that there was this unprecedented step. The government ordered no meetings of any kind for anyone, including churches, right? And so there was a lot of debate for churches. Should we meet? Should we not meet? What should we do when we can't gather together? And so some were arguing that, no. Hebrews tells us we cannot forsake the assembly. We have to be together. And there was a great debate going on. And so J.C. McQuitty, he responded, at this time he was with the Gospel Advocate, and he wrote in the October issue of the Gospel Advocate, he said, "For Christians to urge that we should now assemble in large crowds to break bread in the face of the proclamation of the government is not warranted by the Scriptures." In other words, the Bible doesn't tell us we have to do that. "It will not be questioned that the intent of the government is to protect and care for the lives of its subjects. As the observance of the command does not interfere with a Christian's meeting a few together and observing the Lord's Supper, Christians should observe the command cheerfully, seeking to lead quiet, holy, and unblameable lives." So we hear that and we're like, wait a minute, something changed? Because before, they're all charging into the fray. And now J.C. McQuitty is saying, no. I mean, he's not saying don't help. What he's saying is that it's okay for us not to meet together. So at first glance, this may sound different. It sounds like it's a different response, Christian response in the face of an epidemic, because there's less bold action in the face of danger, right? But I would argue that it is consistent with the Christian ethic, the Christian moral ethic that arose out of Jesus' teachings that was practiced in earlier generations. It's just in a different way, because by 1918 we'd begun to understand how these things spread. Right? The common thread that ties all of these things together is this. In the midst of cultural fear and panic, all of these Christians were finding creative ways to love their neighbors. That was the ethic. Love your neighbor. And there are times when loving our neighbor looks like laying down our lives, or at least putting our lives at risk in order to serve our fellow man as they lay sick and dying. There's times that's what it looks like. And there are times when loving our neighbors means taking steps to avoid spreading sickness to them, especially when they're at risk. That's the loving thing to do. Right? So now, here we are today, how do we put this attitude into practice in the face of COVID-19, setting ourselves apart from the world, and how do we respond to this kind of growing epidemic? Maybe, here's just some possibilities, okay? These are just some things for you to mull over and think about. Perhaps we begin today by resisting the fear that is a panic in various sectors of society. Instead, we model peace and calm in the midst of all the anxiety around us. We might also seek to sacrificially serve our neighbors by prudently abiding by the advice of medical professionals to help slow the spread of the disease. Instead of our own health, we should prioritize the health of the wider community, right? Especially the most vulnerable citizens, by exercising some abundant precaution without perpetuating fear or hysteria or misinformation. Rather than hoarding toilet paper and hand sanitizer and cleaning products that benefit only us or our families or ourselves, maybe we offer what we have up for the benefit of those around us who were unable to get in on the shopping spree of the millennium. Apparently, I was talking to Jonathan, and he said that this last Friday they sold something like $104,000 worth of goods at Food Lion. The previous record for single-day sales was $45,000. That tells you what panic looks like in our community, right? So maybe what we can do is just share what we have with others so that nobody need panic. As schools and daycares continue to close around us, and it certainly looks like eventually everything's going to close, that seems to be the trend, but as they do, maybe we are the ones who offer childcare for those parents who still have to go to work. Offer to take in one family or two families' kids so that other parents can go to work if they have to go to work. There's a lot of options out there for Christian service. Maybe it's going and buying groceries or medications for those who are unable or feel unable, at least, to get out. It's become such a need in our community that that's something maybe we could offer up. Regardless of what you do, I want to kind of leave you with one quote. It comes back from the Cyprian plague of the 3rd century. And Dionysius, again, the bishop of Alexandria, this is what he wrote. He wrote, "Other people would not shrink or would not think a time... Think this a time for festival. But far from being a time of distress, it is a time of unimaginable joy." How could he say this? To be clear, Dionysius was not celebrating death, right? He was not celebrating the suffering that came with this epidemic. Rather, he was rejoicing in the opportunity of these circumstances to test our faith. To go out of our way to love and serve our neighbors, spreading a gospel of hope both in word and deed in times of great fear. And brothers and sisters, we are in a time of great fear. Whether you think the disease is a huge deal, or whether you think people are overreacting, or whether you think that people are taking steps that aren't needed, or whether you think we ought to do more, regardless of what your personal opinions about virology are, we are where we are, and we are in the culture we're in, and we are in a culture of mass fear and hysteria. People are doing things that are not rational. I think we can agree there. So perhaps in this time, we have an opportunity to shine like the stars of heaven, to realize, for the culture to realize there is a difference between Christians and the rest of the world. So my encouragement for you, my prayer for us, is that we live out our faith and love our brothers and sisters as best we can. And if we can pray for you and lift you up this morning in any way, if you need encouragement or strength or forgiveness, we want to do that now. You have a family here who's standing waiting to help you. Let us do that. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?